As we go to various campuses, we meet people that have different backgrounds. Now, as you notice from my accent, I'm not native of Oklahoma. I'm a native of New Jersey, or New Jersey. And when I, thank you, you admit it. You might be from there. Anyway, I used to enjoy meeting different people. Well, the first year out of school, I worked in Boston at Harvard. And then later on, I worked at University of Georgia down in Athens. And then I also worked down in Austin, University of Texas. Anyway, so, I know. But as you can see, from Harvard to Georgia to Texas, I climbed the intellectual scale. Anyway, when I was at University of Texas, I met a guy who had a characteristic I had never known anybody else to have. And that was he had never seen snow in all of his life. Now, growing up in New Jersey is no big deal. But, you know, sometimes in Austin it's pretty rare to see snow. But this fellow was from southern Texas around Brownsville, never seen snow in all of his life. He was married, he was a graduate student, had a little boy David about 5 or 6 years old. And he came up to Austin to go to school. And he was talking about one time it got real cold and it snowed, actually snowed down there. And he was talking about the very first time he and his family ever saw this white stuff. You know, in New Jersey it snows, it's all right. But, you know, down in Austin area, it snows even 18th of an inch. They call off school. You know, traffic accidents all over the place. I mean, now you have snow plows. What do you do with this sort of stuff? But he's telling me what happened. He and his family went to bed, and that night it snowed. And the next morning, they get up to go downstairs for breakfast. As a little boy, David, happened to look out the window and got very, very excited. And he started to shout, "Daddy, Daddy, come here, quick, look out the window, grits all over the place." So I introduce you to Southern Snow. Well, I have an interesting topic tonight I want to talk about for a while. It's called How to Live with Yourself and Like It. And I personally believe that there are repercussions in our lives when we have a difficult time looking at ourselves and really thinking of ourselves in the proper manner. It affects everything we do. I have a talk called Why Couples Break Up, which I'm not going to give here. I've given a lot of other universities, but I only have 2 nights here. But part of that talk, I talk about how low self-image affects even relationships. For example, if you have a hard time with really looking at yourself and there are some struggles you have or weaknesses you have, it's very difficult, for example, how you take compliments. I was dating this one real neat girl and was sitting in the car. I mean, it was a moonlit night, romance in the air, you know, one of those kind of nights. And before, you know, things began to get going, I just kind of put my arm around her and said to her, "You know, I think your eyes are pretty." She said, "Oh, well, they're okay." I said, "I think your eyes are pretty." She said, "Well, they're average." I said, "I like your eyes." She said, "Well, they're okay." I said, "Well, you shut up. I like your eyes." Now, you know what made me angry? I gave her one free compliment and she wormed 3 more out of me. I had to say 4 times, "I like your eyes." In other words, even a low self-image affects how you relate to somebody. I mean, for example, women, how do you respond to compliments? If some guy says to you, "Hey, I like your hair," what do you say? "This greasy mess? I only washed 15 minutes ago and it's already greasy." Or some woman walks up to you, man, and says, "Hey, I like your shirt, this old shirt. I slept in this thing last night." Now, we have a tendency, because we have a hard time often looking at ourselves and liking ourselves, have a hard time accepting compliments. Well, there are many, many other ways that a low self-image affects relationships. I'm not going to go into those tonight. Just simply want to say this at the very beginning, that if we have difficulty in this particular area, it affects not only relationships, it affects your job, it affects how you look at your future, it affects how you deal with people. Understanding yourself is one of the most important things. Socrates said, "Know thyself." He also said, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And I find so many people have struggles in this area. In fact, a man named James Dobson, who's written many, many books, in one of his books, he said, it was called Hide or Seek, he said this. He said, "I believe that people, most people between the ages of 12 and 20, are bitterly disappointed with who they are and what they represent." According to Dr. Dobson, most of everybody in this room then is disappointed with himself or herself. And I really disagree with Dr. Dobson. I don't think it's most people of all ages, people between ages of 12 and 20 are disappointed with themselves, I think it's most people of all ages. I gave a talk on self-image, and this lady came over to me, probably, I don't know, 65 or 70 years old, and she said to me, you know, I have the same difficulties everybody else does. Now, why is that? Why is it that often we have struggles? Oh, outwardly, oh, how you doing? We're okay. But inwardly, we struggle with accepting ourselves and dealing with issues about who we are. Well, I personally believe that it's because society has placed upon you and me a standard to evaluate our worth as people. I personally believe this standard is false. And if you live according to standard, which I will explain in just a minute, if you live according to standard, I would say to you that you will feel discouraged by yourself the rest of your life. Now, I want to explain what I believe is society's wrong way of evaluating your worth, or my worth as a person. The first aspect of society's false standard is called the beauty cult. The beauty cult. Now, let's face it, we are all attracted to a good-looking person, right? If you're attracted to a good-looking person, just nod your head back and forth. Some of you are lying. You're going, no, not me, I'm not going to move my head. I mean, we're attracted. And we all realize this starts a long time before you were born. See, every parent wants a lovely child, right? And parents are very, very sensitive to criticism of a newborn baby. But have you ever seen a brand new baby just out of the oven? What do they look like? A shriveled up prune. You know, and everybody stands around the bed and says, ah, oh, lovely child, lovely skin, lovely eyes, looks just like the father. And I say, the father looks like the kid, the father needs help. I'll never forget the first time I ever saw a brand new baby. This lady had a baby, and by the way, that's the way that usually works. Anyway, I saw this lady, a friend of mine, and I looked down at the baby, and I didn't know the society's wage is supposed to do things right. And in a moment of pure candor and total honesty, I looked down at this baby, and I said to the woman, you know, your baby looks like a blob of peanut butter. She did not appreciate the remark. I mean, you know, you go downtown or a shopping mall and you see a father with a toddler can't even walk, he's kind of going like this all over the place. Everybody says, oh, lovely child, you know, nice skin, nice hair, so cute, nice dimples. And the father's pride goes up a zillion points. But suppose somebody walks over to the father and looks down at the kid and says to the father, oh, I'm really sorry about your kid. Now, inside, we all know that looks don't really have that much to do with our value. That's inside of us. But we put a lot of value on how we look, don't we? Especially when you get to junior high and especially high school when you really get self-conscious. And no matter what standard society has, or no matter what standard is in your mind as to what you're supposed to look like, you discovered very quickly, you do not look like it. I mean, you're either too tall or you're too short, you're too fat, you're too skinny. Maybe you wobble when you walk, your nose is on one side, your eyes meet in the middle, or, you know, maybe your face looks like Zit City. You know, who knows? Of course, some of you are looking at your neighbor and saying, yeah, case A right here. But a lot of times we struggle. And whatever it is about us we don't like, we want to change it. For example, we have a tendency to look at the negative in our lives. Let's say for dinner, I had hamburger, I didn't, but let's say I did. And unknown to me, I dropped a big blob of hamburger right on my chest, right here. I don't know it's there. Now, all the time I'm speaking, what would you be thinking about? When is it going to flick the thing off? It bothers me to see that there. Have you walked around campus with something stuck right underneath your nose? And all day long it wiggles up and down when you talk, wah, 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 you know? And all your friends see, but you don't. They all think, oh, no, blow it off, blow it off. And then you go into the bathroom and you look in the mirror. Egad! You don't want to see your friends for a year. Let them forget somehow. Yeah. We have a hard time with little things that are negative. You can be 99% okay, but it's the 1% that bugs you. I used to live in California. And while I was out there, radio station did a survey among Hollywood stars, you know, the people that we see on the screen a lot. And they asked them many questions. And one question was, if you had the power, what would you change about your life? And I was amazed that every single one of these people said they would change something. Not one person was satisfied with what he or she looked like. Not one person. In other words, society says this, everybody plays the game, but nobody wins. None of us are as good looking as we'd like to be. There's always something wrong. In fact, I went to a human sexuality conference when I was in master's degree work in Indiana, and this lady, woman psychologist, came and talked to us. Somewhere along the day, she made an interesting statement. She said, of all my years of clinical practice, I've never yet met a woman who loves her own body. Isn't that interesting? That all of our lives are fighting the way we look. Have a hard time. Now let me put your minds at ease, because like society says, everybody plays and nobody wins. Let's suppose you're one of those beautiful people. I mean, everybody likes to look at you. I mean, when you walk in the door, man, the women just faint. Oh, there he is. Isn't it hard to walk over fainting bodies, men? It's just tough. Hard to get where you want to go. Women, you know, you walk in the room and the guys go, oh, look at that. Oh, man, look at that. Let's suppose you're one of these kind of people. We know from many psychological experiments that people who get along on their looks when they're young have the most difficult time psychologically handling old age. Because if we all live long enough, and I hope we do, everyone in this room will get sags, bags, wrinkles, dimples, droops, and everything else. And usually you don't see some 85-year-old person say, ah, that's what I want to do, look at that man, look at that man. You know, we have a tendency to be very fickle in our society. We're never quite the way we'd like to be. Always wish we were something a little bit different. That's the first thing, the beauty cult. Number two is called the intelligence game. The intelligence game. Do you know what your IQ is? Do you even have an IQ? Some of us are very brilliant. Now we have two brains. One is lost and the other one's out looking for it. But you know, this started again before you were born, because every parent wants an average birth just to get the kid in the world and have him healthy. But you know, once a child is born, average is no longer sufficient to describe the offspring. Have you ever heard a parent talk about his or her kid? I mean, you think the moon was hung on the kid. I mean, Johnny, do you know what Johnny said? Da, da. That was 6 months before any other kid on the block his age. Janie, you know when Janie put the puzzle all together and the colors in the right place? All right. You've heard of Einstein? Forget Einstein. My Janie's got the smarts. So this child grows up thinking he or she is exceptional. Then the child goes to school. And names begin to come to that child from their friends, like Dum Dum, Knuckle Nose, Dodo Head, Space Cadet. A lot more of you relate to that last one, don't you? Anyway, you know, we have this thing about us. We're never quite as smart as we'd like to be. You may say, well, look, wait a minute. I'm not into this thing. Oh, really? Let me give an example. Let's suppose you are studying for a final examination. And you study for 20 hours, breaks the all-time OU record for studying. Well, maybe it's 2 hours. But whatever that record is, you study 20, 30 hours, whatever else, and you get a C-. And your best friend studies 5 minutes and gets an A+. What would you like to do to your ex-friend? And the first thing you say is, not fair. It's not fair. You know, when I was in graduate school, we were talking about all these tests that people take to figure out their intelligence and all this sort of thing. Going through, you know, measurements. And as a middle-aged lady, I was sitting in our room. Somewhere along near the end of this one particular classroom, she slams down her pen. She shouts out, I don't like any of these tests. Well, the poor professor, he didn't know what to say. He said, well, what do you mean? She said, look, I have taken these series of examinations and these tests 3 different times, and I always come out average, and I don't like being average. I mean, just think of the definition of average. That's most of us, right? But who likes to be average? Just think of the word average. 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 It's sort of like the word mediocre. What's mediocre? That's like having a Coke with no fizz. No. I mean, let's suppose, women, you're out with old Lover Lips himself. Moonlit night, watching the muskrat races. And before he starts the activities of the evening, he kind of slides on over to you and says, "Baby, the reason why I love you because you are average." Kill, murder, maim, right there, right? Men, by the way, don't even try it as an experiment. I mean, none of us want to ever be average. But isn't that the way we are put into categories? Oh, let's suppose you are one of those brilliant people. Like I said before, nobody really makes it. I mean, let's suppose you have an IQ in the ionosphere somewhere and you still have not found a number for you. We have names of people like that. Egghead. Antisocial. Bookworm. Nerd. Isn't it true we always kind of have a tendency to put everybody into their place? Nobody is ever quite as smart. Like there's always somebody else coming along a little bit smarter. Seems to get the better grades, the better job, and the bigger promotion. We say it's not fair. Third and last part of this false standard of society. First is the beauty cult, second is the intelligence scheme. Third one probably really hits hard to all of us, and that's called the status symbol. The status symbol. Now, we all have status symbols. Status symbols are designed somehow inside of us or around us, whatever else, to tell people where we are in our society. Even as college men and women, you have status symbols. I mean, things like maybe the clothes you wear, status symbol. Where you live on campus, status symbol. Maybe the car you drive or the car you wished you drove. Actually, according to Psychology Today magazine, number one status symbol among college students across the board, all over America, is your stereo. Stereo. I mean, when you get a roommate, what's the first thing you want to know? Hey, you got a stereo? No. No! How can I live without a stereo? Actually, some of us can't even walk without some kind of music in our ears, right? Or you get a new roommate. Hey, you got a stereo? Yeah, I got a stereo. Terrific. What kind? Kmart. Kmart. It'll ruin my records. And when you go to a party, you don't want some guy coming along with a little dinky portable. You want the big speakers, big amplifier, wow, you know. And all of our life, isn't it interesting that we like to be around people of equal status or above us? We don't want to spend too much time with people whose status is below us. It might just rub off. Wouldn't that be tragic? So we kind of analyze what people are. We want to be around the in crowd. The people who have the right status symbols, the power people, the in crowd. And let's face it, even the people in the in crowd aren't satisfied. A multimillionaire was asked one day by a reporter, and written up in a newspaper article, and actually even a magazine too, got in the magazines, was asked this question, how much money would satisfy you? I really appreciated his honest answer. He said, just a little bit more. Good answer. I mean, you think of this. As a university person, how much money would satisfy you right now? Just a little bit more than what you have, correct? You know, okay, maybe pay off some of my bills and have a date once every 9 months. Yeah, just a little bit more than what I have. So when you get a little bit more than what you have, how much money would satisfy you then? Just a little bit more than that. And when you get that, how much money would satisfy you then? Just a little bit more. And when you get that, how much money would satisfy you then? Just a little bit more. And all your life, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little more. Have you ever heard anybody say to you, stop, no more money, I got enough right now. Never happens. You ever notice something about our culture? We like bigger everything. We want to get a bigger job when you get out of college, with a bigger take-home pay, a bigger insurance policy, bigger potential for advancement, a bigger pension. So we can live in a bigger house with a bigger dog and have a bigger car, or maybe a smaller car with a bigger price. live in a bigger part of the city, so we got bigger bills coming in and bigger worries and bigger frustrations and bigger ulcers, and someday end up with a bigger funeral. I mean, our clothes don't wear out, they just kind of go out of style. Our computers don't wear out, they just kind of get a little bit out of date. What satisfied you 2 years ago, you wouldn't be caught dead wearing right now. Simply means that things we are trying to accumulate never satisfy us. What do you think about those three things? Beauty, cult, intelligence, game, and status symbol. If you live like that, and let's face it, the majority of our culture does. If you live with those three things in your mind saying, if I have these three things, beauty, cult, intelligence, game, status symbol, I'll be happy because I'll be successful. You'll be a miserable failure. I mean, as a university student, I struggled with my worth as a person. How in the world can I find value? It wasn't easy. I would never match up in those things. And I started to look around and find people who could show me how to live. Show me how to actually enjoy my life. And frankly, I had a hard time finding anybody who was enjoying their life. And there are a lot of great people who have lived in our culture. Maybe people like Mahatma Gandhi, Julius Caesar, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King Jr. Many great people have lived in our world. But it seems to me the greatest person that ever lived is Jesus Christ. They may be saying, come on, Pernell. Jesus Christ is the greatest person who's ever lived? Oh, yeah. For example, even the newspaper says so. You may say, wait a minute, you have not read our newspaper. Oh, yeah, I have. It even says so not only on the front page, but every page. Gives the date, 1986. You say, well, it's a big deal. Oh, it is a very big deal. Because they leave off the last two letters, which they should have on there, which is A.D., Latin, abbreviated for Anno Domini, which means in the year of our Lord. B.C., before Christ, A.D., in the year of our Lord. He split history in half. Nobody else has ever done that. It's pretty good. You go to the library, look up the Encyclopedia Britannica for Jesus Christ, and you'll notice more space is allotted to him than any other six great people who ever lived. Combine them all together. More art, more literature, more advancement of education, elevation of the human being has happened as a result of his influence than anybody else who has ever lived. It's one thing for people to follow when you're alive. Another thing for people to follow you when you are dead after 500 years. It's quite a different thing for millions and millions and millions and millions and millions more to follow you almost 2,000 years after you're dead. That's quite a leader. That's quite a man. Well, how did he live? Did he go according to the beauty cult and intelligence game and the status symbol? No. No way. In fact, for instance, like the beauty cult, do you have any idea what Christ looked like? The Bible never says. In fact, the Bible is unconcerned about looks. Out of almost 3,000 people mentioned in the Bible, I've only come across five or six that says anything about their looks. And their looks have nothing to do with their character. In fact, the first king of Israel, who was head and shoulders over everybody else, his name was Saul, so handsome, so good looking, so much like a leader, they voted him in the office as the new king. He turned out to be a real rat, decimated the country, turned the whole country against God. So his looks had nothing to do with his character. Don't know anything about Christ. Look, oh, there is one possibility in the Old Testament, in Isaiah chapter 53 and chapter 52, chapter 53, the prophet said 700 years before the time he ever got to this earth, he predicted that his face would be marred more than any man's. He even says he would have no form or appearance that anybody should be attracted to him. You know, these pictures you see, Jesus Christ, rakish, handsome, debonair, good-looking dude. I don't think that was Christ at all. I personally think Christ was probably just average in his looks because it never once did it ever say anybody was attracted to his looks. There's always a power of his personality and his message, never his looks. Intelligence game, I mean, how educated was Jesus Christ? Well, folks, he never came to know you. Isn't that amazing? Never came to know you. Actually, never went to any college, never went to any high school, never went to any junior high. He had somewhere around, probably, and I'm only supposing from different kinds of study, he probably had somewhere around a fifth grade education, formal education. He was a carpenter's son. Not much education in those days for carpenter's sons. And yet the profound things he had to say still stuns the greatest intellects in our world today. And his statements are so beautiful in the sense that even though the greatest scholars can't fully fathom all the depths, yet the simplest mind can grasp the essential truth of it all. It's amazing to me that the people he had as his followers were not highly educated individuals. Tax collector maybe was educated, but not the fisherman. You see, men and women, we get caught into this intelligence thing a lot in college, thinking our value hinges upon our grades. It doesn't. In fact, one of Christ's followers even said, God has not chosen the foolish, God has not chosen the wise, he's chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. God's not impressed with your brains or lack of brains. Oh, how about the status symbol? I mean, did Jesus Christ have a status symbol? I mean, he rode around Jerusalem in a Porsche 944. All right, you know. Did he have a secret Swiss bank account somewhere? You know, 14%, hey, pretty good. No. One day he's walking down the sidewalk and he says, you know, to the big crowd, foxes have holes in the ground, birds have nests in the trees, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Didn't even own a house. He had to sleep out under the stars unless somebody invited him into their house. Can you imagine living all your life in somebody else's house? And we went to the cross and the hang there. For you and me, he had a status symbol. Believe it, he had a status symbol. It was a one-piece robe that they wore in those days. And part of the shame that he bore for you and me is that these Roman soldiers stripped him naked of that robe and shot dice at the foot of the cross for the only thing he had left in the world. Can you imagine this, working all of your life and end up when you die at 33 years old with one thing in your life, a robe? You'd call that abject poverty, wouldn't you? Yeah, he's the greatest person who's ever lived. You know, he never went more than 200 miles from his home, never wrote a book, never held a political office. He never did anything that you and I would consider great. Yet he's considered the greatest of all. Isn't that ironical? So how does he teach us how to live? Oh, it's very different than our society. Society says beauty, cult, intelligence, games, that is simple. Jesus Christ doesn't say that at all. It's a whole different standard. I want to explain it to you. The things I'm going to say, you probably have never heard on television. Rarely probably have found some of the stuff in books or anywhere else. But I think if you grasp the things I'm going to say in the next few minutes, it could change the course of your life. Number one, Jesus Christ says, I love you. I want you to understand that. He says, I love you. Now those words, I love you, the magic three words, I love you, we've probably heard people say to us, I love you, but they have changed their feelings about you. You may even say to somebody else, I love you, but your feelings have gone. So to somebody say, I love you, what does that mean? Doesn't mean a whole lot. In fact, I bet you sometimes you said to somebody, I love you, and all you want to do is make out more and get them more excited, but you don't care. So when Christ says, I love you, what does that mean? Oh, you have to understand what the word love means in God's terminology. Love and commitment are inseparable. In the Old Testament, in the prophet Jeremiah, God says, I loved you with an everlasting love and I've drawn you to myself. Isn't that phenomenal? His love is an everlasting love. Doesn't quit when the going gets tough. Doesn't quit when you get maimed or hurt. Doesn't quit when you get old. Doesn't quit when you're on a hospital bed. Does not quit, period. That's phenomenal. Nobody else has love like that. And Jesus Christ said in the book of John, he says, greater love is no man than this, to lay down his life for his friends. And you're my friends if you do what I command you. I mean, it's one thing to lay your life down for somebody you love. I mean, if I had to lay my life down for my wife or my daughter, I'd do it. No hesitation. I'd give my life. But to give my life for somebody who could care less, give my life for somebody who's apathetic, give my life for somebody who just kind of tools around with me all the time, forget it. I'm not going to do that. But Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, says, I love you enough. I'll lay down my life for you, even if you never respond to me. That's a lot of love. So when he says, I love you, he backs it up with his life and his blood. Number two, he says, I accept you. I accept you. Now that's the strangest thing to hear anybody say, I accept you. When was the last time you've heard somebody else tell you, I accept you? They always put a condition on it. I accept you if. You know, I accept you if you look good. I accept you if you're in the right crowd. I accept you if you're intelligent. I accept you if you have status symbols I like. I accept you if. And we're always afraid that the next if we can't meet up to. All of our life, so many of us are struggling to prove to everybody and ourselves that we're not a nobody. When God says, I accept you, it's so different. I mean, when I was growing up, I don't know about you and your home. When I was growing up, the big thing to be accepted when I was a little kid is what you ate. I mean, you have to please mom and dad, correct? So you have to eat what they say. Now, as far as I was concerned, the only two things that I thought were mistakes on the face of this earth. One was green beans. And the other was cold green beans. You ever chomp on a cold green bean, that cold juice shoots in your mouth? Oh, I hated that as a kid. Actually, I was pretty religious because all the time I was sitting at the table with the hamburgers and the french fries, you know, chomping on all that, I'd have those green beans sitting there and I keep praying, Lord, let the beans disappear. But they never did. I always had to sit there and look at those things. My mom would say to me, you better eat your beans and be a good boy. That never held any water with me. Then she'd use another tactic. You're going to sit there until you eat your beans. Now, I was an ornery kid. I figured I could sit a lot longer than my mother could stand. And I sat there, sometimes for over an hour. I could wait her out any day, sitting there. Well, one day was Thanksgiving. My mom had 11 brothers and sisters. That is a lot of kids and a lot of cousins and relatives. My father's side, he had two brothers and a lot of kids. I mean, you can imagine when the whole horde descend. So my mom, great cook. My mom would invite half of the relatives on Thanksgiving and half at New Year's. Couldn't get them all in the house all at the same time. Now, did your father and mother ever prepare you for the relatives coming when you're a little kid? Warn you of an impending doom to your life. takes you aside. Now, Dick, you will be on your best behavior when the relatives come. I mean, if you punch the dog, if you hit your brother, if you push food off the table for the dog, if you move, you will die. Isn't that, aren't you glad to see the relatives come? I was afraid to do anything. But one day, they allowed me to sit up where the big people were. So we get a whole bunch of relatives come, there's not enough at the one table. You got card tables all over the house. And the kids are out on the porch or down the basement. Oh, kids, how you doing? Okay, Mom, you know. First time let me up where the big people were. I'm sitting at the table, minding my own business. My father was right next to me. Very, very important decision of his to sit next to me. He always knew where trouble was brewing. Sat next to me. And all of a sudden, I look up. And much to my horror, there came the beans. And when they got right next to me, my father, out loud, in front of everybody, said, Dick, if you don't take as much as I think you should take, I am going to double it. So I took one bean and said, Dad, okay, double it. You guessed it. He applied the Board of Education to my seat of learning. I mean, but isn't it amazing, even since you're a little kid, you're always trying to be accepted, always trying to do something, look some way to be accepted. And then God says, I accept you just the way you are. Boy, that's hard for us to take. Always want to do something for God. Always want to make up for God. Always want to climb the wrong in the ladder. Okay, maybe by wrong number 17, I'm okay. I'm just down here, number one. I'll work hard. God says, no. Just the way you are. I accept you. It's phenomenal. Oh, number three. He says, I love you and I accept you. The third one's the kicker. He says, I forgive you. forgive you. If you respond to me, I forgive you. You may say, wait a minute. Forgive me for what? I am a college student. What do I have to be forgiven for? Well, let's face it, we're all self-centered, every one of us. Now you say, wait a minute, Pernell, are you saying that I am self-centered? Yes, you are. We all are. Let me give you an example. Let's suppose I take a picture of this large group. I get the picture developed and I show you the picture. Who's the first person you look for in the picture? Oh, number one, right? Ever get a bunch of party pictures back? You preview the party pictures before you show your friends. Because on some of those party pictures, you look a zombie. And you don't want anybody to see those pictures, right? Put those in the drawer. Hey, look at these good ones of me. And because we are self-centered people, we do self-centered things. The Bible calls it sin. We're selfish to the core of our being. And because God created us to have oneness and intimacy with Him, we've decided to go our independent way. No time for God in our thoughts, our plans, our actions. The only time we call upon God is when we get hurt, or some tragedy happens in the family, or some pressure is on us real bad. Okay, we'll pray. Oh yeah, we'll pray. But as soon as the tragedy is over, back to normal. We use God like a crutch. You get a broken leg, well, you hobble around on a crutch, and when the leg is all mended, throw the crutch away. But isn't it amazing about God? He wants your life to be different. Let's suppose by some magic, some technological advance, I could take a movie of everything you've ever thought about in your life and everything you've ever done in the dark. I make a movie of this. And tonight, ladies and gentlemen, on a big white screen, this is your life. What would you like to do when your life is on the screen? Take off out of here. Who wants to see quadruple times quadruple X-rated on the screen, right? Especially when it's your life. But you see, God knows everything there is to know. He doesn't need new technological advances whatsoever. And what He says, I want to come inside that heart of yours, and I want to forgive you, cleanse you, and give you a new heart. That, my friends, is a promise and a gift no one else in the world can give. That's why, when there's no new heart from God, our self-image is easily put down. But when you respond to Him, say, Lord, I need you. Lord, I want you at the center of my life. How does that affect your self-image? Oh, a lot of ways. I want to focus on a couple of ideas. When you open your life to Jesus Christ and let Him be in there, I don't mean just tip your hat to Him on Sunday, trying to press everybody. I don't mean that at all. I mean 24 hours a day, you want Him to work in your life. That is, He lives inside of us. He works in a lot of areas. First thing, He gives us the ability to appreciate our uniqueness. Men and women, there are no two of you alike in the world. But I meet so many people that want to be somebody else. If I can only look like her, if I can only be as athletic as him, if I only had that guy's brains, if I only had that kind of money, I want to be everything but me. You have to learn. And when God's in there, He appreciates your uniqueness so much He gave His life for you. If you're the only sinful person in the world, He would have died just for you. That's a lot of appreciation for your uniqueness. He wants to enhance that uniqueness. Nobody else in the history of the world, no one else in the rest of time is going to be like you. Isn't that beautiful? When God made you, He threw the mold away. No more like you. And He wants to enhance that. He wants to be the generating power within your life. Number two, not only does He give us the courage to appreciate our uniquenesses, but He gives us the power to develop our strengths. Now, we all have strengths. But isn't it easy to overlook the strengths? I mean, if I ask you, put on a piece of paper, what things you don't like about yourself? Big long list. Maybe use 3 or 4 pieces of paper. But if I ask you, put on things you really love about yourself, you may have a hard time. Because you're unique. He gives you the power to look at yourself like a raw diamond. You don't find raw diamonds on the surface. You find them deep down underground. They're dirty old rocks, really. But a master jeweler understands what's happening when he sees that rock. He begins to cut it and shape it, clean it. When he's finished, it's a beautiful jewel of great price. That's the idea of what God wants to develop. You know, people say, you can be anything you want to be. I hear it a lot. School kids, they say, be anything you want to be. You know, that's an impossibility. You cannot be anything you want to be. I used to play the trumpet. I always wanted to be a great trumpet player. I was terrible. I mean, the more I played, the more I lost my friends. I played in bands. I played on street corners. I played all sorts of things. It was horrible. And I finally had to realize I am just not musically inclined. If you sat next to me, if I ever started singing, you would realize that I'm not musically inclined. But I realized I have other strengths. And God had to really teach me that maybe some of the things that I thought I could do, I couldn't. And some of the things I never thought I could ever do, He's helped to guide me. Last, not only does God want us to appreciate our uniqueness and to develop our strengths, He wants us to accept our weaknesses. That's the hardest of all the things. We have a tendency to look at our weaknesses. We don't like them. But those weaknesses, believe it or not, are there for a lot of reasons. One reason is they drive you to want to know a relationship with God. If you didn't have any weaknesses, you wouldn't want to know God. You'd be so proud, you wouldn't need anybody. But God realizes that the best place for you is a deep personal relationship with Him. And so we have weaknesses to drive us to Him. And what God wants to do is not to smother those weaknesses, but He wants to put you in contact with other people who have strengths where you are weak. He brings people together. He gives us a oneness with other people so that they're strong and I'm weak, and together we're strong together. In other words, what God does, He takes our needs and He brings them together, other people have other needs, and begin to see a harmony between people, because there is a oneness with that relationship with Christ. And many women, I realize this may be an interesting talk for some of you. Maybe you've heard it a lot, maybe you've never heard it before. I'm simply here to say that self-image is wrapped up in a relationship with God. To understand who you are and where you can go, you have to understand who the Creator is and what He can do in our lives. I don't know what He will do in your life. I have no idea. But I do know this. He wants to establish a relationship with you. That's why He gave His life. To open up the door. To forgive our sins. He rose again from the dead in great power. Nobody else has ever done that. Because He wants to live in our lives with power. He can set you free to be all, not that you want to be all that He wants you to be. And therein lies a dramatic difference. Now, tomorrow night, I'm going to be talking on sex and intimacy. And in that talk, I'm going to talk about why is it that what we think is really good turns out to be sometimes not so good. I'm talking about sexuality. I'm going to talk about some of the issues about intimacy. And why is it so often that when we think we have love, it doesn't always continue to be love. A lot of times there are a lot of problems and breakups. I want to talk about how do you find intimacy. But underlying all I'm going to talk tomorrow night is your self-image. How you look at yourself. Do you accept yourself? Do you enjoy who you are? Are you willing to face your weaknesses? I want to give you a suggestion. Two actually suggestions. One is adopt a no-knock policy. Adopt a no-knock policy. That is, next 24 hours, you try this. Next 24 hours, you don't knock yourself, tear yourself down, or anybody else in any way. Try it. If you start a sentence where you're going to say, oh, this is horrible food, or good night, look at that girl. Man, that guy can't drive. What am I here trying to do this thing for? Whenever you find yourself saying a negative sentence, think in your head, no knock. I gave this at a university in Mississippi, and next night I was speaking in a sorority house. And the president of the sorority house, before she introduced me, talked to me on the side. She said, you know, I'm really angry at you. I said, why is that? He said, because you told me about no-knock policy for 24 hours. I said, that's right. He said, you know, for 24 hours, I've not been able to carry on a complete sentence. We're always kind of tearing ourselves down. I say, next 24 hours, think about who you are. God's made you unique. And ask God to give you a positive attitude about your strengths and your weaknesses. Number two suggestion I have is this. Establish a deep relationship with Christ. Tonight, before you go to bed, just get alone. Some of you probably have heard this till you are blue in the face. Some of you never heard this sort of stuff. It doesn't matter if you heard a lot or not. The point is it personal? I mean, just because a person grows up in a Christian home doesn't mean he's a Christian. Just because a person grows up in a garage doesn't mean he's a car. It's a personal reaction. I just say, take a walk tonight and just think about who you are and yourself. That's hard to do. I mean, you can go through 4 years of college and never think. You know, you give it back what teachers say to give back, but to think about yourself tonight, because I've talked, just get alone. No friends around, just you and your thoughts. God, if it makes sense to you, Jesus Christ died on the cross because he loves you. He accepts you the way you are and wants to forgive you and give you a new purpose and direction in life. He wants to be the center of your heart. He died on the cross. He rose again in great power. If you believe that, say, Lord Jesus Christ, I don't know a whole lot about you, but I do know you gave your life for me. I need you. In the quietness of that time, to say, Lord, I want you to make me the kind of person you want me to be. Now, if you do that, God says, you open the door, I will come in. He'll begin to develop that relationship. He establishes a relationship with God, eternal life, new purpose, a direction, many other things. But he also gives you courage to learn to be who he's created you to be. It's not an easy thing, but he's there guiding and directing. So I suggest two things. One, get a Bible out. I know it may be hard to find one, correct? I mean, when you find a Bible, you have to cover it, get the dust off. Oh, man, a Bible. I never knew I had one of these things. Start reading, especially in the book of John, chapter 3. Read it three times before you go to bed tonight. Just look at table of contents, John 3, three times. It talks about a new birth. You'll be amazed at the things you'll learn. The other thing, I suggest, just find someone else that you know is a person who has given his heart or heart to Christ. And ask the person, how do you learn to deal with your self-image? How do you learn to understand some of these things? How do you learn to have that new power within you? How do you understand Jesus Christ in your life and know him in a personal, deep way? Hopefully that person will help you out. They want to get a discussion group started, whatever.